Welcome back to week two of the talk Connect and Inspire. We talk about conversational intelligence, basing it partly on the book by Judith Glasner called Conversational Intelligence. Judith Glaser. And today we're going to talk, follow on from last week, and we're going to talk a little bit about trust and how it relates to conversations. So just to review a little bit from last week we began talking about conversations, the difference between conversations that build connection rather than division. And we talked about conversations not just being communication, not just being something that we share information or facts, but a powerful tool that can either enhance a relationship or destroy one. We brought in the Kabbalistic idea of speech being an idea of malchut, that last layer of our consciousness which absorbs what we think and what we feel and then puts it out forward in a much more powerful way, and if it's not just operating on its own, but it's really operating in terms of what we feel and think and so on. Words create, words reveal, words connect and bind, which is why the Rambam, and we talked about this in some length last week, says that the importance of not speaking badly about someone, not only in terms in the context of Lashon Hara, but just generally, even when we reprimanding or inspiring or trying to challenge people to use the most positive language we can, because actually the positive language actually brings out the positivity in the person. And therefore, the point of effective communication is really to turn adversaries into partnerships, right? And we talked about the essential shifting, therefore, from conversation being two eyes talking to each other to becoming a we, to becoming a unit, right? And therefore, to be mindful of the choice of words that we use, to understand that words do trigger emotion, and that words, and that was the last point we made last week, that words are very rarely neutral. So words have such a power, they always trigger something, and they're not neutral, and therefore we need to be more mindful of the way we speak. Okay. So what I want to do today is begin by understanding the power of a conversation and how the choice of words sort of, even especially at the beginning of a conversation, create like the vibe, they create like the direction of the conversation in a very, very big way. And it's so important, the messages, the hidden messages that we send when we're using words. I saw in her book, she brings from a Pentagon spokesman that once gave a press conference about the Vietnam War, and he said the following. He said, "I know that you believe you understand what you think I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant." Right? And that's what it is. You can have two conversations with the same content, but it gets heard very, very differently, right? And depending on the choice of words that we use, depending on our mindset, depending on our attitude, as Judith Glasser says in the book, she says, conversations are multidimensional, not linear. What we think, what we say, what we mean, what others hear, and how we feel about it afterwards are the key dimensions behind conversational intelligence. So just to explain this a little bit, come in. Just to explain a little bit, in the book which we're talking about, she uses this idea of feel good and feel bad conversation. I was going to read to you a little bit because she says it very beautifully. She says the following: When we are having a good conversation, right, even if it's a difficult one. Now remember that conversations sometimes have to be difficult. That doesn't mean they can't be positive, right? Because that's we had a whole series of this once. Difficult conversations, right? Difficult conversations are important. But when we have a good conversation, even if it's a difficult one, we feel good. We feel connected to the other person in a deep way, and we feel we can trust him or her. In good conversations, we know where we stand with the others. We feel safe. That's a big thing she goes into about feeling safe in a conversation. And she says, in our research over 30 years, trust is brought up as the key description of a good conversation. That's interesting. People will say, I feel open and trusting. I could say what's on my mind, or I don't have to edit anything. I can trust it won't come back to hurt me. Right? And therefore she says, conversation are the golden threads, albeit sometimes fragile ones, that keep us connected to others. And why is that important? Human beings have hardwired systems exquisitely designed to let us know where we stand with others based on a quick read of a situation. And she goes on and explains that a bit. So what happens is like this, right? In other words, what she's trying to say, I believe, is the following. In every important conversation, it becomes very quickly obvious to everyone in the conversation, either consciously or subconsciously, if the conversation is two teams competing with each other and each party protecting themselves, you know what I mean? We have a conversation, you feel sort of it's a bit of a tennis game, we're all trying to win. Or is the conversation a relationship of two people on the same team, right? Reaching common goals. And even though the ideas, the methods, the pathways might be very different, but we're trying to reach a goal together. And that's the essence of really the difference between a good conversation and a bad conversation. So just to quote her again, she says the following. She says, when we are in conversation with others, perhaps even before we open our mouths, and this is so true, we size them up and determine whether we trust or distrust them, right? When you start a conversation, very quickly we make judgments, right? Very, very quickly. Once this happens, our brains are ready either to open up or close down. Bad conversations, especially if the conversation begins badly with the wrong language, trigger our distrust network, and good conversations trigger our trust network. Each influences what we say and how we say it and why we say it, and the networks even have a heavy hand in shaping the outcomes of each conversation. So what we're going to talk about today is probably one of the most difficult things to do. At least I talk for myself, put it that way. Right? Because it's very difficult not to judge. We all, as human beings, like make judgments. And it's very difficult to really trust someone. And it's very difficult to go into a conversation with real trust. And I'm going to show you what that means in a minute, because you'll see how difficult it really is. Right? So in other words, what does it mean feeling safe in a conversation, right? So feeling safe in a conversation where both people feel safe, it means that we're connecting to other people, right? So when we speak, what are we actually doing in a conversation, any conversation? Even if, by the way, even if we are the person trying to influence the others, and that sometimes is legitimate, right? Sometimes we're in a position where our job is to inspire other people. But we still have to trust them, and we still have to listen to them, and we still have to learn from each other, right? And receive from each other. So every conversation is a give and take. See, part of the problem is often we go into a conversation only giving. Or our intention, our aim, or we think our aim, is just to give. You know, I need to have a conversation with that person because I really need to let them know. I need them to change their practice. I need them to act differently, behave differently, talk differently, whatever the case is. Could be with a child, could be with an employee, could be with anyone, right? But as soon as we go into conversation where we're the only giver and we're not receiving, we're not learning, it's not going to work. Because as we'll see, when we distrust, they all distrust, and it becomes two teams trying to win, right? All of this, when we go in sincerely trying to listen and trying to learn and trying to explore, all of that, of course, builds trust, right? The absence of trust, when we go into conversation not trusting, can come from various different sources. It can be various reasons. Now, very, very often when we go into conversation not trusting, it's our own insecurity. In fact, we don't trust ourselves really, right? I think we once spoke about this at length. We're actually scared to listen. We're scared to learn. We're scared not to be right. We're scared to admit maybe we made a mistake, right? Because we were so convinced. Generally, we are convinced that we're right. I mean, most people, right? No? I don't think so. Most people go into conversation with their opinion being right. Most of the time, at least, anyways, right? So the insecurity that we have, obviously we know insecurity equals ego. Arrogance. Arrogance comes from an insecurity. We've talked about this a lot. Fear of the unknown. We're not sure where this is going to go. We're not sure how it's going to work. We're not sure of the reaction. And just fear of the unknown, generally about connecting to someone we don't know very well or someone we're not sure how they're going to react, someone who might be different than me, someone who might have a different perspective, right? Now, it doesn't mean when I go, as you've said so many times, it doesn't mean we go into conversation that we have to necessarily agree, but we have to be ready to learn. We have to be secure enough in ourselves to hear something different. It's fantastic to give a share on this topic. It's not so easy to implement, right? I'm in this with you. It's a difficult thing, this. Now, very, very often, it really begins in the beginning of the conversation. Why? So I just want to share with you an interesting Kabbalistic idea. And I'll show you where it actually manifests itself in a particular custom, actually. So in Kabbalah, they talk about relationships, and particularly with regard to marriage, right? Where marriage is a very intimate connection. It's a very internal connection. It's a very deep connection. It's what Kabbalah refers to as kiruv pnimi. Kiruv means coming close, and pnimi means very, very tight, right? And Kabbalah says that before you can have a kiruv pnimi, anytime, you have to have a kiruv chitzoni, which means like this. When the an outer, a more general connection, what does that mean? When you deeply connect with someone, it's very tense. It's two very different worlds coming together, not easy always, right? It's a difficult process. It's a difficult journey sometimes to navigate. And therefore, Kabbalah says exactly this. Kabbalah says you've got to warm up the waters before. You've got to warm up the situation before so that there's a readiness to embark and engage in that kiruv pnimi. And it's interesting, in Chabad circles, there's a particular custom at every, like, how do I remember this idea? Because there's a particular custom at every wedding. The groom at the Kabbalat Panim, at the, what they sometimes people call the Chosin Stish or whatever, they recite a Hasidic discourse. They all recite the same one. It's one that was connected to just general knowledge. It's one that's, if you ever went to a Chabad wedding, you'll notice that well, you won't notice because you're the women's side, but on the men's side, oh, you would notice because you're a photographer, of course. So you would know this. That's right. So you know that the Chatan says the Maimer, right? You know what I'm talking about, yeah. So what's the Maimer is the same Maimer that the previous Rebbe said at the Rebbe's wedding, and therefore became it's got pieces of teachings from all the different Rebbe's. That's a very spiritual experience. But one of the concepts that explains in that Maimer is this idea. Right? So next time we hear it, you'll be able to know what they're talking about, right? So it's this idea of the Badekan. Why do we have a Badekan? Why does the Chassan go and veil the color before the Chuppah? So it says it's the Kiruv Chitzoni, because the Chuppah is the bond. The Chuppah is when the two souls actually really come together in a very deep way. In order to do that, you've got to create a general feeling of connection. And that's the reason you have a Badekan. Right, the Badekan is that first initial coming together to make way for an effective, deep connection.
What is the translation of Badekan?
To cover. It's a Yiddish word.
Badekan.
Yeah, Badekan is a Yiddish word. It means to badek.
Cover. But it's not lived out, it's to examine?
No, but that's in Hebrew. But Badekan is a Yiddish word.
It's to cover.
It's to cover, yeah. In fact, the cloth that the color wears is called a dek tichel. In Yiddish, it's like a cover cloth. Yeah. Right? Since you asked the question about the word badekan, on Shabbos, you know, we cover the challah with a challah cover. So in Yiddish, it's called the challah dekel. If you ever heard that word, it's challah dekel, that's what it is. It's a challah cover. So same word. Okay. Now in that concept, right? In that concept, that same Maimer brings an example in a different context from how you see this idea. And it comes from the famous piece in the Talmud, which we've mentioned before, that it talks about the great sage, Rabbi. Rabbi was one of the great Talmudic sages. And it says that Rabbi was a serious person, he was a great sage, and he would give every so often shiurim to his students. He would teach them in-depth Talmudic law, right? Now, just the context, so you understand how powerful this is, because it says in the Gemara that the system of teaching, that when the Talmidim, originally when the students would sit in front of their Rebbe and they would hear this lecture to learn a new concept in Jewish law, an in-depth concept, it was a very serious situation. The reverence was big, they were talking about a big sage, that they would just listen, they wouldn't even analyze or ask or engage because they would do that afterwards. There was a thing about just being completely there, to use present and to use the terminology of the Talmud, biyirah, in other words, with awe and respect, and that's the way, that was the atmosphere, that's the way it was done. However, says the Talmud that before Rabbi would begin his lecture, he would start with the milta de b'dichuta, he would start with a joke, something light. Why? Ubatchi Rabbanan, says the Talmud, because then the sages would chuckle a little bit, smile, the atmosphere would be warm, and then they'd really be able to understand the shir. Right, so that's the age-old tradition that some speakers have, always start with a joke, but which is sometimes good, sometimes bad. But that's the way you would do it, right? Because he felt that if he really wants them to really be there, which will be done in a very serious and internal and almost solemn context, there needs to be that warming up before. Because it's two worlds. It's students receiving from a teacher, learning something new, learning something they're not used to necessarily. The atmosphere has to be ready. And therefore, the truth is, it's true with every conversation. Every conversation depends a lot on how we start. How we start will depend on, are we building trust? Are we building a connection? Or are we messing it up right from the beginning? And the beginning, if the beginning doesn't go well, it often goes downhill from there, right? Very, very hard to turn around a bad conversation in the middle. Once everyone has their backup, it's very, very hard, right? And sometimes what we do is, in a conversation which is a little bit tense, particularly if it's a bit of a tense conversation, by the way, when I say tense, it's not only about conflict. It could even be of analyzing something. You know, when we were in yeshiva, I've said this to you many times, we used to fight a lot, and that was by design. When we used to learn chavruta for most of the day, we'd argue out stuff in understanding the Gemara, the Rashi, the Rambam, whatever the case is, and we used to scream at each other, right? And that's the way it was done. That's the way it's done in yeshiva. Because each one would defend their position, and that's the way it's supposed to be done. It's passion. Yeah, that's why it was done, because that's how you get to the bottom of the thing. But it only worked if there was a general respect, right? If we weren't screaming at each other to fight, we were screaming at each other to prove the point, but yet be ready to listen to the other boy's point of view. And those chavruta that didn't do that, where one was out just to prove that he's completely right and didn't even listen to what the other one was saying, it never ended well, right? So it was a good system when it worked. In other words, when there was initial, so it doesn't have to be a conflict conversation. Anytime there's a conversation with two different points of view, the same thing happens. If we're not a team, if we don't connect, if there's no trust, then we go into fight mode, right? Because we feel threatened. And when people feel threatened, it's flight or fight, right? That's what happens. So you're under pressure. So you go into fight mode. So you're even more pushy and more pushy. And the more pushy you get, the more backup the other person gets, and it doesn't end well, right? So I'll just bring an interesting example, because in the book, in Judith Glass's book, before she wrote Conversational Intelligence, way before, she was doing a lot of clients and coaching in companies. And she talks about a coaching job that she got that was a disaster, right? Because she wasn't aware of all this stuff. And she got involved in someone called Anthony, who was CEO of a company. It was a very important position, and he wasn't working out with his employees, right? So it didn't go well, because she kept trying to push him, which was a job, she thought, but to get him to change. And every conversation wasn't going well. After, she says like this. She says an interesting thing. She says, my frustration with not being able to have open and trusting conversation with Anthony led me to start making movies about him in my head while we conversed. Right? And it's really true, this. It's so true. Because what we do when the conversation is not going back, when we're two opposite teams, we start imagining things. We start creating narratives, or the way she calls it, we start creating movies about the other person. I found myself being very critical of Anthony's ways, his style of talking, his intentions. I found myself leaving empathy behind and putting judgment first. I imagined Anthony as an arrogant bully and continued to embellish my feelings about him when I cast him as the worst leader I'd ever met. Right? So once that's there, so then she understands later, nothing was going to work. Right? And then she says, I'm not sure it was my fear of failure of Anthony's stubbornness or low level of awareness that took me off my game, or worse yet, a combination of both. I was convinced that he didn't get how important connecting was, right? So she was trying to teach him how to connect to his mentees or his employees, and she was doing exactly the opposite, and she talks about it. And also told myself that he didn't really care. By the time I had cast our relationship in hopeless terms, I was unable to do what a good coach should do, facilitate a wake-up call for change. Instead, by slipping into my movie making, I contributed to our failure to connect, right? And then later she says the following. She says, after a lot of attempts, I realized that he too was composing, directing, and starring in a movie in his mind about who he was, what he needed to do to be successful, and why I was wrong and he was right. And of course, upon reflection, she realizes that her fear of failure to push him harder, they both got caught up in being right. She talks later in the book about the disease of addicted to being right. Sorry? Right, the right fight, exactly, right? So being addicted, and therefore we all got trapped in that need to be right, and it didn't go anywhere. And therefore what happened was, she says, when you're in the need to be right, she gets caught in something else, which she refers to as, I was caught in the tell, sell, yell syndrome, right? Which is the way often a lot of us have conversations, right? Maybe not, the volume is not so high, but that's the style, right? trying to sell them on the reason that you are right, then yell. So first you want to convince them, so you yell because you think if you yell, it's going to really convince them, right? And I tell this to teachers all the time, like when teachers shout in a classroom, no one actually hears what they say. It works sometimes temporarily for a few moments, and then it's a surreal thing. If you ask a student afterwards what did the teacher say when they were yelling, they actually have no idea. Because they turned off, they were frightened, didn't feel safe, and had no idea what they were saying. Right? So at the end it got worse, and after 6 months they both fired each other, and it didn't actually work. Now, this concept of trust, we just explore it a bit of it. So I'm going to share with you a very fascinating story in the Talmud. Because it shows how even conversation with us and God, how God trusts us, even though we're prone to making a lot of mistakes. Now, I warn you, this is a piece of Talmud which needs a lot of explanation, exploration, understand exactly what it means, and so on. But I'm just going to take out the point that's relevant for this discussion. Because the reason I'm sharing this with you is because trusting doesn't mean that you believe the other person is perfect, right? But it does mean that I'm not always right, not in God's case, of course, but it does mean that I'm not always right. And it does mean that the other person has what to offer, right? Now, that's a very big difference. In other words, my job might be, as in a coaching job, for example, when she's called into a company to improve someone's performance. Obviously, that person needs to change, right? We understand. They've got weaknesses where they need to... Ultimately, the goal is change. But if you go into a conversation thinking the other person is completely wrong and has nothing to offer, then the conversation can't go into it. Because, as we'll see later, if you don't trust someone, they don't trust you. It's reciprocal. Trust is reciprocal. And we'll see in a minute how that works. So therefore, even when you're going into a conversation where you need to influence the other person or inspire change within the other person, you need to be able to know you can also learn from the other person. So the person might not be perfect, but you can also learn. So before I tell you that, Talmud, let me just tell you something else first of all. Right? There's a very famous, I think I've shared this with you before, but there's a very famous, in fact, I'll tell you a funny thing. I wrote an article about it once that I was just Googling on Chabad.org, trust, and I'd forgotten about this concept, and my article showed up. I said, that's good, I'll use it for this year. among other articles, because I have some articles there. But anyway, so that was funny. But so there's a piece in the Imprekei Avot. This is before I get to that interesting passage of the Talmud. There's a piece in Imprekei Avot that says, talks about the famous concept we've mentioned hundreds of times about the importance of making ourselves a mentor, right? So it says, in the one passage, this is the way the Mishnah reads. It says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya said the following. He said, make for yourself a mentor, acquire a friend, and then the next piece is, and judge everyone favorably. Now, everything's exact. It didn't just happen to say these three things together. But, make yourself a mentor and acquire a friend seems to fit together. It's talking about effective and healthy relationships to have in life. One of the relationships is a mentor. The other relationship is a true friend. Understood. But how does the next piece come in? Right? And I think it comes in for the following reason. Often, and people do this a lot, I've heard this a lot of people do this, you engage someone as a mentor, for example, or you get involved in a person as a friend. Why? Because you were attracted to certain qualities they have. You saw in the mentor a good person, you saw in the mentor something very, very, very valuable, right? A friend is the same thing, you hit it off because you have common interests, common values, common goals, etc., etc., right? So you connect with them, and for the first part, it's like a honeymoon. Oh, what a wonderful person. Amazing. If you met this person, he's like the new Mashiach on the block. You know, like it's unbelievable. And then suddenly, after a couple of years or a couple of months, he's not such a Mashiach anymore. What happened? You discovered, he's a human being. He's perfect. He's not perfect. He has deficiencies. He didn't always exactly return your calls. He didn't always do what he was supposed to do. No? Early on in the rabbinate, someone once gave me advice, which I didn't heed, by the way. But he said, you should only be around my one place for 5 years. He says, after a while, they're going to start finding all the things wrong with you. It's time to move on. Anyway, haven't heeded the advice. But anyway, I hope it was okay. But why? Because that's the way it works. Often people enter into a relationship with people, and then you discover, So Rabbi Shimon Prachi says, make yourself a mentor that you can trust, acquire a friend, and remember, they're not perfect. They have what to offer. Judge them favorably. Because every person has deficiencies. So if you discover something wrong with them, as long as it's not extreme corruption or terrible things, but it's not completely inconsistent with what you have to learn from them, understand there's a context, maybe you're not interpreting properly, or maybe you are and they're just human beings, they made a mistake and that's fine. Right? Because that's what trust really means. Trust doesn't mean you enter any conversation works like this. If you're going into a conversation with someone, you need trust. Trust doesn't mean there's a wonderful person. In fact, sometimes not. I'm going in to help change. But it means they have what to offer. And if I need to trust, they have what to offer. They have something I can learn from. And if I need to explore that, I need to ask them to teach me. Whatever the conversation is. Right? So here comes the interesting perspective on a story in the Talmud. There's a system of how Jewish law works, right? So we have, just to give you the context, we have something called the written law and the oral law. And the oral law is open to interpretation, and there's a system you have to follow of how to interpret law, even up till today. And the system is very prescriptive. God gives us a system, and we can't deviate from that system, otherwise that's not following the Torah. But within that system, there is sometimes reason to have different perspectives, which is why in the Talmud is full of different arguments, full of different perspectives, right? Anyone who's ever learned any Mishnah or Talmud would know that the rabbis are always arguing. And then there's a way how you conclude which one to follow, how you rule at the end of the day. One of them is, in the times of the Talmud particularly, that when there was a big discussion, a big debate, and a majority held a particular perspective, once they decided it's time to establish what the law is, they would follow the majority. Right? That's the system God gave us. So the Talmud tells a story about a particular law. It's not really what the law was, because it's a complicated issue of purity and impurity. That the Sanhedrin, the great supreme Sanhedrin in Yavne, got together. This was just after the destruction of the second temple. And they had a big debate about a particular halachic question that had come up. And all the sages held one way. They came to a conclusion one way. And Rabbi Eliezer came to a different conclusion. Okay? So it was him versus the rest. But he was very convinced that they'd made a mistake. They'd actually misinterpreted something. That they were both using the same system, doing their best. But he was convinced that they had made a mistake. So he pops up and he says the following. He says, if I am right and you are wrong, let the carob tree next to the shul prove it. And sure enough, the carob tree, a miracle happened and the carob tree started to violently shake or whatever. And they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't prove things from carob trees. Right. So he said, okay, if I am right, let the river next to that's over there, let it prove it, and the miracle happened, and I don't know, something that dried up or something happened, right? And they ignored it. Finally, he said the following. Now, I'll just give you again a context. There was a concept called the bat kol. Bat kol were heavenly voices, which according to the Talmud still happens today, just we don't hear them. We don't have the right bandwidth to pick up the frequency, right? But there are sometimes heavenly voices that heavenly messages that come up, and you have to be on the level to be able to tune into it, which they were, of course. So Rabbi Eliezer says, if the law is like I say, let heaven prove it. Let heaven prove it. Now this is getting serious now, right? And sure enough, a heavenly voice came out and said, what do you want from Rabbi Eliezer? He's right, the law's like him. At this point, listen to this, Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says, too bad. Too bad. Too bad. Why too bad? Because there's a system that God gave us. Part of that system, it says, even though we know Kabbalistically that there's schools and yeshivas in Gan Eden, in the spiritual world, they also study and there's all kinds of discussion that's going there, and they see things a lot clearer and so on and so forth. But the pasuk, the verse in the Torah says, Lo bashamayimi, the Torah was given to us down here. And God gave us the rules of interpretation and says, now do your best. Follow the system. If you don't follow the system, then you're out of the system. But if you follow the system, do your best, and that will be my will. And therefore, Rabbi Yeshua says, it's very nice that a heavenly voice came out and said that halakha is like Rabbi Eliezer. Too bad. Rabbi, Achrei Rabbim Lahatot, we are taught to follow the majority, and that's what we're going to do. And the halakha remained not like heaven, not like Rabbi Eliezer, but like the rest of them. So the fascinating story is, afterwards, that the Talmud says that Rabbi Yeshua, who's one of the members of the Sanhedrin, who was the one that had declared that we're not following the heavenly voice, he had a revelation of Eliyahu HaNavi, as we have a tradition that, you know, Eliyahu HaNavi comes to our house on Seder night and by a brit, but also there's a tradition that to certain very, very great people, he reveals himself from time to time, right? So Elijah the prophet. So Rabbi Yeshua meets Elijah the prophet, and Rabbi Yeshua says to Elijah the prophet, tell me, what was God, how did God respond when we chose to ignore him? What was his reaction? So he said, obviously metaphorically, Eliyahu Navi said, God smiled, and he said, Natschuni banai natschuni. My children have won over me, my children have won over me. God was really pleased. Right? Now there's a lot to unpack in that story. And it goes to the heart of what Torah is, and you know, in a few weeks' time we're gonna have Shavuot. Shavuot is the festival of receiving the Torah and how it works, and that's the whole concept that it's a relationship and it's a partnership, and actually God gave it to us to interpret, again using this particular system, but he said, do your best with the system, and because God only gave us the principles. He didn't give us all the laws, all the details of the laws. I don't know if you ever looked on the Chumash is very brief, right? Yeah, certain things are clearly, and certain things were given orally to Moses, as we have a tradition, we hand it down from generation to generation, all good. But a lot of stuff comes up all the time. We believe Torah is eternal, and Torah is a response for everything. So how do we work out the law? So God gave us a system, how to do it, and how to interpret it. And we do our best. But it's not just we do our best. And this is the point of why I brought this. God said, I'm giving it over to you, because I trust you. I trust that if you follow the system, you can do it. And therefore, it means that I trust you to implement the law. I trust you to the point that if you follow the system and you generally try to reach the truth of what the halakha is, even if I didn't see it quite the way you see it, even if in the heavenly yeshiva they didn't quite see it the way you guys see it, you follow the majority. So if God, who really sees the truth, could trust us, we need to learn that trusting someone else doesn't mean that they're perfect and doesn't mean they always get it right. But we have to learn to trust people on some level. Just, I thought I'd share this because it's a fascinating, fascinating concept. Right? In other words, I mean, in context of the story, we believe that, I mean, part of the tradition is that Torah was given to us because the Torah keeps the world going. The existence of the world based on Torah, right? How does Torah work? How does Jewish law work? How does Jewish observance work? God said, the system is divine. And you follow the system, and I'm going to trust you. And even when it was clear that in heaven they wouldn't have come to the same conclusion, but really God was smiling and he was saying, I want, because my real desire is that you have to have input. The real desire is I want you to own it. Because if you can't trust someone to own something, then they're not going to follow it properly. Which is why, by the way, and this is a whole other discussion, why we find it very interesting in Jewish history. Why the Jews were very, very inspired by the giving of the Torah. It was the most amazing event. Mount Sinai, miracles, mountain smoking, and who knows what. They had just come out of Egypt, watched the 10 plagues, saw the miracles of the splitting of the Red Sea, and 40 days after the giving of the Torah, they served the golden calf. Why? One of the reasons is because at that point, all the inspiration, all the influence, all the amazement of the journey from going out of Egypt till the giving of the Torah wasn't theirs. They didn't own it. It was all from above. It was all God's revelation, which was the way to start the process. But when you don't own it, it doesn't stay. So if you have a conversation with someone, or you have an interaction with someone, and you want it to have some influence, you want it to be inspiring, there has to be a trust within that person to contribute to that conversation, to teach something in that conversation, to participate in that conversation. So that's why trust is so important. And if the conversation begins with no trust, it just goes nowhere, right? Because as she writes in the book, she says, no matter what we're doing in our professional lives, trust is the single most important element in the process I call creating we, which is the name of a company, by the way, right? And therefore, with every conversation we have, on some level, we always have to ask ourselves the question, is this a conversation between two friends or between a friend and an enemy? An enemy doesn't mean someone we necessarily hate. It just means conflict. As what's his name? The famous guy who created the Love Lab. Skip my mind now. I mentioned him before, but he a very unbelievable researcher in how relationships work, right? He set up this lab where he used to observe couples and how they fight and everything and predict if it's gonna work or not. Anyway, I've forgotten his name now, but he says the most important thing, he says marriages, for example, that people never argue is a very boring and an ineffective relationship. You only grow through arguments. But his whole philosophy is, when he used to observe how couples argue, it was how that he has something called a hard startup, right? In other words, if they start like this with insults, with putting down, with being an adversary, it goes pear-shaped. It always doesn't go well. But when people have arguments where they arguments to learn from each other, to defend their position, but to respect each other's position and to listen and to learn, it's beautiful. Right? Now, the good news is, I didn't say the easy news, but the good news is that trust can be built. Not only trust can be built, because you know, often people say, yeah, that's good for me, but how about the other person? Right? Often we get that question, right? So there's a very famous piece of wisdom from King Solomon. Very famous line. King Solomon wrote Proverbs, and in Proverbs there's amazing lessons for life. And the famous, one of the famous pieces of advice, he says, as a water reflects a face back to a face, so one's heart is reflected back to him by another. Kamayim ha-panim el-panim. Which means, just like when you go to a river to draw water, he says, and you look inside the water, you'll see your reflection. If you're smiling, the reflection will be smiling. If you're angry, the reflection will be angry. Right? So too it is with relationships from one to another. Because trust is built in a reciprocal way. People want to be trusted. People want to be valued. And people will give that back. Not always, but there's a good chance. So therefore, if you go into a conversation thinking the other person maybe doesn't trust you, you can't change the other person, but you can change yourself, as you always say, and you can trust, even though it might be difficult. And if you trust, there's a good chance they'll trust back. I just want to share with you a beautiful story I heard yesterday. Many of you would know that a few months ago, tragically, my niece passed away in America after a very long battle with mental illness, and it was quite tragic. So my sister-in-law, it's my brother's daughter, so my sister-in-law, her and her classmates have a weekly, I think, WhatsApp learning session in her honor and her soul. So yesterday, a few days ago, they got Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson to do a, because he's actually a cousin of my sister-in-law, so they got him to do a session. Anyway, he spoke very, very beautifully, and she sent me the link, and that's very, very beautiful. And in the beginning, he tells an unbelievable story. I'll just share it with you. It's a story about a great Hasidic Rebbe called Reb Nochum Chernobyler. Nochum Chernobyler was the son of a great Rebbe. He himself was a great Rebbe. He was known as a miracle worker. He was a saintly man, a righteous person, an amazing person. Anyway, he had a custom that on Matzei Shabbat, on Saturday night, I guess to farewell the Shabbat, he would go in a wagon with some of his students, a horse-drawn wagon. They would go somewhere like in the forest, sort of nature, and they would, I don't know, have a Malava Malka, they would sing, they would meditate. I'm not sure exactly what they would do. One time, they got into the carriage, and they were traveling, and suddenly a pack of wolves came out of nowhere and were going to attack the horses. The horses froze, and it was a tense moment. It was a very sort of dangerous moment. No one knew what was going to happen. And the Hasidim looked at Reb Nochum Chernobyler like, what do we do now? So he jumped off the carriage, and he opened up his shirt, and he stood in front of the wolves. Listen. Suddenly they calmed down. I mean, don't try this at home, but he, right? Suddenly they calmed down, and each one very slowly came next to him and sniffed around his heart. And then went back, and each one did this. When they finished, they just stood still, and after a few moments, they just left. That's the story. So he got up in the carriage, and all the Hasidim were amazing, a miracle. And he turned to them, and he says, yes. No, this could be a real true story. I mean, because there was, around that time, there were Hasidic rebbes that did create, I mean, the Baal Shem Tov, they did like, right? You remind me of a good saying they say, you know, there's lots and lots of stories of the Baal Shem Tov like this. So obviously they grow, and there's lots of stories that happen, lots of stories that didn't happen. So I once heard there's a Yiddish saying they say like this, that if you believe all the stories of the Baal Shem Tov, you're a fool. If you don't believe them, you're a heretic. In other words, it definitely could have happened. Is this particular one, I'm assuming it's true, I don't know if this particular one is true, but it could have happened. They were the kind of people that could have happened, right? I mean, if you know the Baditshava Rav, Nochum Chernobyler, there was great, they did amazing things sometimes. However, in this case, listen to this. In this case, he jumps into the wagon. He sees the look of wonderment and amazement of his Talmidim, of his Hasidim. And he starts and he says, before they have a chance at anything, he says to them, you think it was a miracle? It's not a miracle. So they said, what do you mean it's not a miracle? What was that all about? He said, let me explain to you. Let me explain to you what happened. Which, by the way, what he said dates back to a story in Tanakh, actually. You know the story of Daniel in the lion's den? Yeah. That he went to the lion's den and they didn't touch him? So he said like this. A human being is such an amazing thing. He says, a human being is created in the image of God. Right? An animal won't attack a human being. Animals are very sensitive. We know this. And animals often have a greater sensitivity than humans do. Animal will not attack a human being if they see clearly the image of God imprint on the human being. Now, which is why they didn't attack Daniel in Lion, because he was a great tzaddik and he was a pure person, right? There's a similar story with Reb Chaim ben Attar, who was a great Kabbalist who lived like 300-400 years ago. About 400 years ago. The same story was by the king, the sultan, I think. He was thrown into a lion's den, nothing happened to him. But he said like this. He said, when does an animal see the image of God on a human being? If the human being has no trace of heart, of hate in their heart. No trace of hate, that's what he said. When I saw the wolves, he said, I had to stop a few moments and make sure that I don't have a trace of hate in my heart. When I was confident that I do not have any hate, I jumped off the carriage and they sniffed around my heart. That was the symbolism, I guess. Right? When they saw there's no hate in me, they ran away. They didn't attack. Right? So I heard the story and I was in the middle of preparing this. I thought, it's such an appropriate story. Because we all have wolves in us, right? Which part of us attacks each other? It's not our soul. Our souls are selfless. Our souls are humble. Our souls want to learn from the other. It's the animal part in us, right? It's the wolf in us that has an ego. It's the ego in us which comes from the animal soul, as we've discussed very often. That's the part that creates conflict. That's the part that doesn't make room for another human being. That's the part that looks down at another person. That's the part that judges another person, right? When we get rid of the wolf within us in relationships, their wolf doesn't attack. Their wolf runs away. So I just thought that because that just wants to highlight the point that trust, building trust is reciprocal. The more we trust, the more it comes back. And this happens on all levels and it happens on a very, very simple level, right? It's just a matter of learning. This is so hard. It's just a matter of learning how to be humble. It's a matter of learning how to trust. It's a matter of learning how not to judge, and it's a matter of learning how to move away from the addiction of being right. Right? So let me tell you a different conversation that she tells in her book. I'm coming back to the book, right? Where she had learned these techniques, and now she got a new coaching assignment, which she did very differently this time. And she said she got called for an interview for an executive coaching assignment at Verizon. Verizon is a big telephone company in America, right? She didn't have a lot of hope. The guy that she was going to coach was a guy called Rob. And he had worked with 12 coaches before, nothing had worked. So it's not a good track record. And she started doubting whether she has a chance, but you know she has to do things differently this time, right? So essentially he was in charge of a team, and they were all reported to a big CEO, and he was not getting anywhere with his team, and it wasn't working, right? So she talks about the first conversation she has with him. And she said to him the following. I'll read you the conversation because it's interesting. She says, tell me about your leadership style. What's it all about? So he says, I see myself as a best practice leader. So she says, tell me how. So Rob says, I really see my job as developing people to their best. Right? And she says, okay, so what does best look like? She says, I send my people home with things to read about leadership. I make sure they are being challenged to do more and better every day. I hold them to their word and make sure they deliver what they said they would. When we are doing work for the CEO, I make sure to go over to each draft again and again until it's right and perfect. When I'm on the road, I call in over everyone's and go over everyone's to-do list, make sure they have delivered on my expectations. That's what best looks like. In other words, I don't trust anyone. Yeah. Right? So she says, that's interesting. Are they reaching their best? Right? So he says, most are not. And I keep motivating them and pushing them. And then he pauses and says, maybe it's time to fire them. By the way, this is an unbelievable thing. I've watched this in parenting a lot. I had a conversation once with a parent who was having difficulties with a teenager, but the teenager was a younger teenager, and I know this person well, and I knew exactly what they were messing up on, right? It was just the way they were just treating their child wasn't going to work. They were pushing an agenda, which was a good agenda, the value was good, but just the way it was being pushed was completely ineffective, right? And I sort of tried to bring it out to them, right? So eventually I asked them, but the most amazing thing was, like the amazing thing that happened, it was amazing to see. He had done exactly the same thing with his first four children and failed. right? But people have this notion, if it's not working, he says, I pushed him harder. So in his mind, it was such a good way to do things, it just didn't work, so I didn't do enough of it. Right? So I've got to keep doing it, I'll do it more now. I didn't work 4 times, but this time it's going to work, so I'll do it like 200%, right? So essentially, she started doing a lot of research, but she had very non-threatening discussions with him. She tried to learn from him. She was asking him. She was asking what his leadership style is, what his goals were. And a lot of them were good. I mean, a goal to bring out the best of people is a great goal, and you can pick up on that. That's a fantastic goal. That's really good, right? But then what she did was she went and interviewed the team, right? And she said, listen to this. It's unbelievable. What is the one thing you would want Rob to change that would make a big difference in your life? And all reports focus on the same thing. They update calls in their weekly meetings. His staff said, when Rob is traveling, we have phone calls to update on our to-do list. He never asks us how we're doing. He tells us what to do, right? Going back to the thing, there's never the breaking of the ice. There's never that joke in front of the... There's never that warmth before the actual connection, right? So even if you're an authority and someone has to report to you, but a care, an interest in them, right? Some like, how you doing? How you feeling? Kind of thing, right? The same was true for our weekly meetings. He goes around the table and asks about our progress. He treats us like children. It's insulting and embarrassing because if we are not in line with his expectations, he will say something about our progress and embarrass us in front of our colleagues. We live in constant fear and stress. Now, in a business model, a lot of them don't leave that, even though probably they should, because they need a job, right? And they have to go somewhere else. But in translating us to regular relationships, where people could leave or people could not associate with us, that's even more important that we keep the relationship healthy. And then she says, when asked what one thing they would change beyond everything else, they replied, just for once, he should ask us what we think or what we want to talk about or what's on our minds. Right? That's the crux of all of it. So how does it all work? So therefore, let's just summarize this. First of all, remember, we once did the 7 habits of Stephen Covey, right? And it's really exactly what the 5th habit said. The 5th habit is, seek to understand, then to be understood. And I think I told you then that I once heard a lecturer who was a student of Stephen Covey, and we asked him, it was a course that I went to, we asked this particular guy who came up from America, we asked him, what does Stephen Covey think about his own habits, and which one did he think was the most difficult? And he said that question was asked him, and Stephen Covey said that out of his own habits, he felt that the one that was most difficult was this habit. Seek to understand and then be understood. Because if I'm having a conversation because I really think that you messed up, so it's so hard for me to understand you, right? And yet it's so critical. It's so critical. Because so often it's not about right and wrong. And even if it is about right and wrong, you still have to understand where the other person's coming from. Because people want to be understood. If a person doesn't feel understood, there's a wall up right away. If there's not that kesher, if there's not that connection, if there's not that engagement where they feel an equal, they feel a partner, they feel that you really care about them, there's no way they're going to listen. Even if it's a right and wrong scenario, even if it's a right and wrong and you know they're wrong and I need to change. And sometimes it's like that. I mean, with children it's like that sometimes. Just use an extreme example. Right? With parents and children, we have a lot more experience, we have a lot more wisdom, and even if they're an older child, sometimes we just know what is wrong, what is right. But we still have to understand. And they need to feel understood. And if they can't feel understood, there's no way we're going to get through. Seek to understand, and it's reciprocal. Because when we seek to understand, then we have a much better chance of being understood. How much more so if it's not a case of being right or wrong. Sometimes it's not right or wrong, just 2 different perspectives. And if we really need to understand, we need to explore that alternative truth, maybe, as we've talked about many times, right? So therefore, people want to be treated well. People want to be valued. So what we need to learn to do, and this is hard, because it is a hard thing to do, we actually need to learn to practice trusting. I think it's a skill that we actually have to practice. Not just doesn't come naturally. I think most of us don't have this naturally. Most of us, when we engage in a conversation, we want to convince someone of something, it's very hard to trust, truly trust. Truly hard to trust and to really think that I have something to learn from this person and I really need to understand where they're coming from and maybe the way I look at them will be completely different and I won't judge them. Because how many of us often start a conversation and we've sized up the whole situation already before we start? We already know exactly what's going on, right? It's natural. It's the default position of most of us, but that's why we have to practice it. We have to let people make mistakes as God, well, it wasn't a mistake, but God gave us a system and he says, you do it to the best you can, right? We have to let people share. We have to ask them what they think and trust them, and it does work 2 ways. Now, of course, a lot of this has a lot of strategies, a lot of different components to it, which we'll develop over the next few weeks, but that's a very important foundation, a very important introduction. Have a wonderful week and a wonderful day.